Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, John Rawling and Ian Dark. What a fabulous trio this is. Guys, we're really appreciating your feedback on social media where you're sharing and spreading the word about Ringside Rewind, and also where you're rating and reviewing on iTunes. Some of the reviews have been absolutely fabulous. Plenty of five-star reviews coming in. This week, we are going to talk about press conferences, which was actually a suggested topic from one of the iTunes reviews. And we've been at plenty of pressers over the years. John, I mean, I'll start with you. Is there a presser that stands out above all others, or do they all meld into one after a while?
Well, I mean, I guess recent memory serves me best. And I think the Fury Wilder press conferences were fairly extraordinary. And maybe particularly the third one for their third meeting, because Wilder had initially almost tried to say nothing. And Fury repeatedly went at him, and eventually he reacted, and they just wound up sort of talking across each other, plenty of obscenities, and the thing was just totally out of control. I mean, it generated a lot of publicity. Whether or not it generated anything in terms of psychological edge for the fight, I'm not convinced, but that was one which stands out, and it was just mayhem.
Ian, how about you? Anything that stands out for you?
Well, I think probably, I mean, the ultimate press conference bust-up has to be that one between Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis in New York, doesn't it, at the Hudson Theatre? Yeah, where, you know, they have the fight before the fight. You know, Tyson came in looking for trouble. That, you know, that the two fighters are brawling on the floor. I think there was like a $56 million lawsuit handed out, you know, all hell broke loose there. But, you know, you think about press conferences and you think, why do you hold a press conference? Because you're looking to publicize a fight. I mean, it's fascinating the way I think it's gone. And it probably started with Muhammad Ali. I mean, we weren't around when you know, Rocky Marciano and Ezzard Charles and Joe Lewis, you know, in that era. How did they hype up the fights then? Maybe they needed a bit less hyping up, because there wasn't so much competition from other sports. But now, it seems to me that if you've got a pay-per-view boxing event, and let's be honest, most of them are pay-per-view boxing events, the big ones now, you have to kind of whip up this kind of often phony grudge and hatred between the fighters, or stage-manage something to get the event into the newspaper, to get some attention, to get some column inches. And I think I've spoken about this before. Often, when something like that happens and a brawl breaks out, you know, the columnists will all come and write saying, oh, boxing's name was dragged through the mud again, but they're writing about the fight. They're giving it publicity. So who was going to do that before? So, yeah, I mean, if you want to mention one, it would be that Tyson Lewis one, I think. But you know, often, to be honest, I got bored stiff with them in Las Vegas. You know, we did Don King for 50. Do you remember, John? We used to have a little bets, side bets. How long would Don King talk for before we actually got to hear from the fighters?
Oh, he'd literally do 40 minutes, wouldn't he? 40 minutes or more. I think there was one of the big fights in Vegas. We had an hour-long monologue from Don King before you ever heard from anybody. And, you know, if you've not heard it before, the first 2 minutes you think, oh, this is quite good stuff, and you're sitting there writing it down, and it keeps going for an hour, and by the end of it, you're losing the will to live. I think the thing that changed most of all about press conferences, though, is that, and why they've become so sort of phony, as you call it, and so much hype, so much grudge, supposedly, between the two is that it's no longer really a newspaper press conference. Newspapers don't really matter anymore, I don't think, in selling a fight, or certainly not to the extent that they did before. Nowadays, it's about TV coverage, TV hits. Yeah. It's about the internet. It's about YouTube. It's about people like IFL, you know, and I don't think newspapers really matter quite so much anymore. So it's become so much more visual and audio, and therefore they try and sex it up and try and hype it up as much as they can.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is as well, you know, when you look at press conferences, we had the AJ Jermaine Franklin press conference to announce the fight last week, and then obviously we'll have a press conference for it on Fight Week. So they do come thick and fast, don't they? Ian, I mean, Ian, John's hosted some. You've never got your hands dirty in that respect, have you? You never hosted any.
Oh, well, I'm going to have that row again now, aren't we, that we had before.
I'm just trying to stir the pot.
I'm sympathetic to John because there's a lot of pressure these days. You know, if you've got a job as a commentator and the people who are paying your money, if they want you to go up front and host the press conference, it's hard to say no because you want to keep the gig. There's always the chance I'll get someone else who will do that. But certainly in my time covering boxing, if anybody had asked me to host the press conference, I'd have said absolutely no way, because I think once you're hosting the press conference, you become part of the promotion. You know, you're there kind of puffing up the fight for them. And I don't see that as the commentator's job. The commentator's job is to call fighter A against fighter B the best way he can. So that was my pretty simple outlook on it. I never tried to fall in love or become friends with the fighters. I had a working relationship with them. But I'm sounding a bit holier than thou there, an old school, aren't I? And I know John's had to do that job a few times. But I mean, it is a bit of a tricky moral position, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Because there'll come a point in the fight where you're having to sit and stand as judge and jury as what's going on in front of you. Yeah, and I hear what you're saying on that one. But, you know, we all have bills to pay. I had a mortgage to sort out and a family to provide for. So doing those press conferences, you know, provided money. And I guess a lot of people would say, you know, that the bottom line is if you're paid and if you're paid enough, you'll do it.
Yeah, what do you think, John? What do you think would have happened if you'd have said, no, I can't do that. I just can't do that. It compromises my position too much. They wouldn't have sacked you from doing it, would they?
No, they wouldn't. But they'd have got somebody else to do it, and I'd have been left with a sizable hole in my income as a result of not doing it.
Yeah, fair enough, I guess.
The thing is, as well, John, and there's two parts to this. Really, is one, I suppose, if you've got the gig as the lead commentator, you're providing the soundtrack of the show, the event, really. So there's no harm in providing that consistency as being the voice of the show from the start of the press announcement. Yeah.
Well, I think it gives you a greater insight by being close to them and hearing them talk. You get a greater insight into what the two fighters are thinking about each other. You talk to their trainers, their managers, and you get a close idea of what the vibe is.
Don't you think, though, that, I mean, this is interesting. What if you've got to say it's a big pay-per-view show and there's a suspicion anyway that the main fight is something of a mismatch, really, dressed up as a big grudge fight that we should all be interested in. And it's all over in a round. And you've got to say this is a farce. You know, I've said that before, even though it's been when it was a Sky Sports pay-per-view event, just occasionally you have to say, you know, almost, you're almost saying sorry to the audience. I mean, and one that springs to mind was David Hay against Audley Harrison, which was, of course, a joke night.
Yeah, absolutely. And more recently, Tyson Fury and Derek Chisora, which I think everybody close to the sport knew was just not a contest and was never likely to be so, and showed to be utterly one-sided when it came to the night. That wasn't a contest. I hear what you're saying on that one. You know, I mean, I'm quite relieved that I'm quite relieved that I'm not involved in the publicity for the Paul versus Fury fight coming up, because that's a very difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so very difficult when it, you're trying to maybe help sell the pay per view for the television company that you're working for, but also you have to be honest as someone who is hopefully something of a specialist in the sport and has the inside track. I mean, one I remember was Amir Khan fighting Dimitri Salita up in Newcastle, and we had to do all these countdown shows all week, you know, trying to build this fight up. And we'd seen Dimitri Salita on several undercards in the USA and knew he had absolutely zero chance of doing anything in the fight. It was a mismatch. And all I kept saying when I came on is this, I think we're going to see something spectacular. I mean, what I meant was it's going to be a first-round blowout, and I think it was. So, you know, you're trying to talk about and being economical with the truth maybe about something you know to be not really great product.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, one of the things, we'll just change gears a little bit, because one of the things that I wanted to talk about, you mentioned Don King's monologue, and there are these huge introductions, particularly in Las Vegas, where you go to a press conference and people go on and on and on. And if you think you're right, and you've got a couple of hundred words to slot into a newspaper, or 300 words or whatever, you basically need about two quotes, maybe three lines from the protagonists. And sometimes it's 45 minutes before anyone says anything of any consequence. You've got, and I've got this sort of a running joke that I have with some of the guys in the press pack where, you know, everyone thanks Al Heyman first, and then they thank God in that order. So they thank Heyman first, then God. Then they go on about sponsors and hosts and everything else. And by then you're 20 minutes deep and you haven't got anything that you can write. And it's crazy. And then, you know, more and more people come up and they thank their people and they thank their people. And before you know it, you know, like you say, really, with the Don King thing, you're an hour deep and you've got absolutely nothing and no one said anything. And then, you know, you get these manicured sound bites. Unfortunately, we're not in football where the same cliches are trotted out. But generally, certainly on a fight week one where the fight's a couple of days away, it's, you know, like you can say ad nauseum, training camp's been great, best training camp of my life, in the best shape I've ever been in. You know, what do you want them to say? Oh, you know, I strained my calf 2 weeks ago and I've been hobbling around for 10 days, but hopefully it will hold out. I mean, I don't know what you expect them to say, but they are very, very they can be very, very bland.
Your great old predecessor at Boxing News, Harry Mullen, a friend of Ian and ours from years gone by, sadly no longer with us, he always used to say, I won't go to press conferences, and he didn't. He didn't go. He used to say, I'll find out what I need to know by talking to people around the camps and to the fighter, and the press conference doesn't matter a jot. By going there, you're dancing to the promoter's tune, and he just refused to go.
Yeah.
Do you remember...
Yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, you're going on, Tris, about how they introduce everybody. I mean, at those big Las Vegas ones, like at the MGM, they'd go through... You'd have to hear from Seth Abraham, the boss of HBO. You'd have to hear from the chief executive of the MGM. You'd have to hear from the guy from the sponsors. And eventually, then they'd go to the undercard. I mean, they're all sitting up there, about 40 people. I remember Bob Arum one day. He's trying to sell some undercard fighter making his debut. He goes, I want you all to look out for Abdul Karameen, who's going to be appearing on this bill. We got big hopes for him. He's going to be a great, great, great middleweight one day, and you're going to be on the start of something, so I'd like you to pay a lot of attention to him. And one of the journalists shouts out, where's he from? He goes, oh, I don't know, one of those Stan countries. You're selling this guy, you don't even know where he comes from.
Jeez.
I mean... that was hilarious. I mean, I used to like Tyson during his press conferences. He just used to sit there looking really, really bored. Like, why have we got to go through all this rubbish before every fight? I mean, do you remember the one with Frank Bruno? And Frank had thought of this line that they'd worked out before they got to Vegas about, You know, he thinks he's Superman, but I got kryptonite to beat him. So Frank going out with that line. So I said, what do you say to that, Mike? And he goes, I don't know. We've heard this so many times. We'll see Saturday. that was his contribution to the press conference.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I suppose, John, with what you were saying there, John, about Harry and stuff, there is a sort of etiquette, I suppose, in terms of press conferences, because when I first went to the presses in America, this is the very first time, so many, many moons ago, they would put out a buffet, as I'm sure you guys both know. And, you know, you have the press conference and then there's a buffet there. And I remember for years, I never ate anything because I thought I didn't want anyone to think I was in the promoter's pocket. So I don't want them to say, oh, Don King had brought me lunch or anything like that. Yeah. So all these people that are just working members of the press that obviously do need food, and it saves you going out, not just financially and all the rest of it, but it saves you leaving the press center where most of the things are going down anyway. So it's your advantage to stick around. But I kind of thought, I'm not going to eat at the buffet that a promoter's put out, because then people are going to assume that I'm in league with the promoter, which was obviously never the case.
Well, I saw you eating a few donuts, Tris.
What you needed to do was get a dodgy receipt from somewhere and put a whack load of money down and put it down as entertaining Don King.
Well, unfortunately, the boxing news expenses never spread as far as the BBC's. I can certainly say that.
Let me tell you, when I started covering boxing, it was Mickey Duff in control of the scene. And you would not believe that the press conferences. We used to go to a place called the Sportsman's Club on Tottenham Court Road in London. And we'd get in there and there were all these tables set out. It was like a huge, lavish meal. So you'd have there'd be a prawn cocktail or something to start, and then you'd have grilled salmon, new potatoes, you know, vegetables, the full works. Then there'd be like a strawberry gatto or something with cream afterwards and coffee. And then Mickey would start talking about his fight and the fighters. It was a full slap up do. And I remember thinking, as a young BBC reporter, going down there with my machine, I'm thinking, blimey, this is amazing. You know, I don't need to eat for a week after this.
God, I wasn't doing it right, was I? Bloody hell.
You weren't. I mean, I didn't know. I thought that's just what you did. Yeah, it's Colin Hart and Peter Moss from the Daily Mail and all the rest of them and Neil Allen and Sidney Holes all sitting around wolfing down this food. I thought, well, if they're giving it, I'll take it. But I guess that was Mickey's way of saying, you know, there is no such thing as a free lunch. I'll expect to see a few page leads about this tomorrow.
Yeah, I do find it interesting. John, I mean, so tell me this, John. If you were a prize fighter and you had a press conference coming out, you know what the drill is and what's expected of you. What would you try and get out to the public on, you know, say Thursday of fight week? What are you trying to use the press conference for as a fighter?
Well, I think I think that may have changed a little bit. Because press conferences have changed, haven't they? They're trying to show that they're real, and they're trying to show that they're up for the fight. But the days when you could go along and pretty much say nothing, as Tyson did and Marvin Hagler did, I think those days have now gone, because you are reliant so much on pay-per-view, and in order to get pay-per-view hits, you need to have a sort of crossover marketability and say something or do something which is, you know, vaguely outrageous. Some fighters are just not cut out for that. You know, you think that, you know, some of the nice guys, you know, like the Lancashire lads, Jack Catterall, Anthony Crawler, they're never going to say anything horrific, are they? But I mean, Derek Chisora is a prime example. He's got the idea of doing something, anything, at a press conference, which will get headlines. He, in his heart of hearts, I'm sure, knows that he's not the greatest heavyweight in the world. But if you pick up a table and lob it at your opponent, as he did at the press conference for the Dillian White fight a few years back, you know, that's something which people are going to say, Jesus, did you see Derek Chisora? He threw a table at Dillian White. You know, and that's and unfortunately, you might say that's naff, but unfortunately, that's to an extent the way the sport's gone.
Ian, seen anything like a flying table?
No, I mean, we were talking about press conferences and right at the beginning, and of course, we forgot to mention the Nassim Hamid one in America. You know, I mean, that was kind of the that was one of the most traumatic, if you want, press conferences. You know, he's trying to make a big impression in the United States, and it's an Atlantic City fight, and far from a charm offensive, he goes to war on the entire press. It was around the time he was breaking up with Brendan Ingle. He was fighting Wayne McCulloch on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and arrived late because of the row going on with Brendan. Tried to throw Marco Antonio Barrera, who was on the same card, out of the gym so that he could train. That went down. You know, you can imagine how that went down. Then sat in the press conference and started calling Colin Hart Colin Fart, and then Colin Fart. And then some guy from the Mirror asked something, or one of the other papers, and he said, "I'm fed up with you. You keep asking me questions you've already asked." And on it went, you know, and he got into a big contretemps with Adam Smith on that trip. I think with you as well, didn't he, John? So he was at war with the world. I mean, there he was trying to market himself a little bit in America, and it was the biggest own goal I can recall. It was extraordinary, wasn't it, John? That.
Yeah, I mean, he self-combusted around about that time, didn't he? And the press conferences which he gave over there were so immensely counterproductive that everybody who, you know, sort of given him the benefit of the doubt, particularly in the British media in the past, when he rounded on them like that, I think a fair few of them thought, right, you little shit, you're going to have some payback time now. And I think he was on the receiving end of that. And he got a very, very bad press around the time of that fight. And to an extent, I don't think he ever really recovered from that in public esteem. You know, by the time he fought Marco Antonio Barrera, I think there were a fair few people and a fair few people in the media who really hoped that he was going to get beaten, which duly he did.
Yeah. I mean, to his credit, his dad, who was always in his ear and didn't like some of his excesses and some of the brashness, I think he gave him a real dressing down over what happened in Atlantic City. And we got this extraordinary call. I think I might have mentioned this before, to come to the Dorchester Hotel and meet him. And he was in very smartly dressed. And he said, sorry to me and Adam Smith. And he said, look, there were things going on and I apologize. I didn't mean to come over like that. So you got credit where credit's due on that front. But at the time, it was horrendous.
It's funny. Sorry, John. Yeah, here you go.
I was just going to say, just quickly, one of the things about when he finally got up there and fought Barrera, you know, the press conferences then, he couldn't really wind up Barrera because Barrera had very little English. And so, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of psychological games to be played and won or lost at the press conferences. And of course, as we all know, when it came to the fight, Barrera completely trumped him because everybody had expect Barrera to be on the front foot, wading in, forcing the fight against Naz. And that's precisely what he didn't do. He fought on the back foot pretty much as a counterpuncher and made Naz look very, very limited. And when he came to, you know, sort of changing his tactics in the ring, Naz wasn't able to do so. And after that night, his career was effectively over.
It's funny when you talk about fighters going off message in press conferences. Obviously, there was that one with Naz that you recall, where he's rounded on the British press, and you know Wayne McCulloch's barely even a walk on act in his own fight. I remember when David Haye and Tony Bellew announced their first fight, and David Haye spent his whole segment rounding on Eddie Hearn, who was promoting it, and talking smack about Eddie. And it was the most bizarre thing. And I think David then later said it was to try and make Tony feel like he was a bit irrelevant and not particularly important. And I think David then put his hands on Tony. I think he either slapped him or punched him. I can't remember which one was which. But Hay was another one who had these interesting presses. And John, were you there at Upton Park when David and Chisora did their press conference behind the grid where they kept aside?
I did, and that really sprang from what happened after the Chisora Klitschko fight over in Germany in 2012, when it all kicked off afterwards with David Haye and Derek Chisora. They had to be separated by security men. The police were involved. Derek was warned by police. David Hay and the police wanted him. He went missing, didn't he? And what actually happened was he managed to find his way back to the airport and effectively hid in the airport waiting for his first flight out the following morning. But I know all about that because I went back to the hotel. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's a great crash on the door. The door opens. You know, they've got a key or something. There's bang, 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 and they come charging in. And there's three or four police there, armed police, come crashing into my bedroom saying, is David Hay in here? You know, I mean, I've not totally blameless on having a few big nights on time to time as I traveled the world, but I can assure you I never had David Hay in my bedroom.
The lawyers are listening.
There's a policewoman involved as well at the start of this. And when she came in and started shouting, I thought it was somebody had organised a strippergram or something. And it was only when the guns started being shown that I thought, Jesus, this is serious. And said, no, David Hay is definitely not in here, and I have no idea where he is.
Well, the H. Chisora one that eventually happened in Upton Park, obviously they were kept behind a fence to stop them, to prevent the bloodletting, I guess, was the angle. But it echoed what was done between Ricardo Mayorga and Fernando Vargas in Las Vegas, where they were kept in sort of perspex crates away from one another so they couldn't get at one another, which I know is naff and tacky, but you've got to think of new ways to try and, I suppose, capture the imagination, because as we've alluded to, the same old format on tap can get very, very tiresome. And I guess
do you remember Riddick Bowe threw a glass at Jorge Luis Gonzalez? He absolutely lobbed a glass at him. And I think on that same fight, Lennox Lewis turned up at the back of the room in one of the press conferences, and Bowe was trying to call Lennox a fussy and all the rest of it. And it very nearly kicked off then.
Bo had previous, because he smacked Larry Donald in the press conference for theirs as well, didn't he? Left at right hand, a two-piece.
Yeah, he could throw a good combination, Riddick.
And then we've obviously talked about Barrera, and then obviously, Ian, this was probably one that you were at, or certainly covered it later on, but Barrera Morales, there was no love lost there, was there? They tore into each other at a press conference, didn't they?
Yeah, they really did. Did not like each other big time. I mean, Barrera was kind of almost middle class, his background, wasn't he? And Morales was from Tijuana, and he was the blue collar guy. But you know what a mixture it made. In a way, the fight didn't need any kind of big hyping or selling. But they couldn't help bad mouthing one another at the press conference. But there are some fights that just sell themselves, and I think that was one of them. I think it is a bit sad now, but it is the reality that, you know, people feel that they do have to do stuff like throwing tables around at the press conference to get it some publicity. I mean, I could remember press conferences going back. I remember going to one for that, what turned out to be a great little fight for the, I think it was for the British middleweight title, Roy Gums and Mark Cayley. Remember, well, there was the Kayla Christie. Do you remember Kayla Christie, the bust up on the cobblestones outside? That was a famous press conference. But going back to Roy Gums, when we were at the press conference for him, and he spent the whole time moaning, saying nobody'd ever given him any publicity, had this big chip on his shoulder. And I asked him for the interview, to do an interview for radio afterwards. He said, I don't talk to reporters. So I said, that could explain why you don't get too much publicity, Roy. I said,
you mentioned that Kayla Christie bust up on the street, Ian. I mean, once upon a time, back in the day then, the British Boxing Board of Control had the guys in front of them and fined them and gave them a real, you know, heavy fines, and would give them a dressing down saying any repeat of this, you know, and you'll have your license suspended. But how times change from the days of Roy Clark, John Morris, who sadly passed away recently. What a good secretary of the Boxing Board of Control he was, by the way. Since those days, things have changed. You know, now things kick off and you sort of shudder at some of the language used and some of the actions between the fighters, but they just turn a blind eye. It's as though everybody now accepts that this is part of the show, and I think it's a sad step backwards, personally.
You can actually, I think, sometimes get more mileage. I think Dillian White got a fair bit of mileage, didn't he, by just not turning up to the press conferences for Tyson Fury. So everybody wrote about that, didn't they? Everybody wrote about the guy who wasn't there.
You could argue he didn't turn up to the fight as well, couldn't
he? Well, yeah, that's another thing. I mean...
On the heavyweight subject, and by the way, that was interesting because that was a similar thing, you know, by the way, in terms of what Ian was saying about Roy Gums there, was Dillian White saying he never got his due and never got the coverage. And then when he had a couple of months where he could have been front and centre, he disappeared. Mm-hmm. In terms of the heavyweights, were either of you there when Herbie Hyde and Michael Bent had their roll around that was about a decade on from Kayla Christie?
Yeah, I was there.
I think I was. I don't remember much about it, but I remember there was a sort of a squared up to one another and all that.
Well, they were rolling around suited and booted in puddles, weren't they?
It wasn't a good look. It's a bit of a Millwall thing, isn't it?
Mm. It was at Millwall, wasn't it, that fight?
It certainly was. Den.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, when we talk about pressers as well, you've got to, you know, for me, it's a lot about the characters and a good chance to get the characters out. And for us to tell the stories a little bit, obviously in our varying roles, whether it's radio, TV or print. And it's about, the best stories, obviously, and I suppose the most high profile grudges will have good and evil. And I suppose there's been no better example of would you sort of good and evil. There's been no better example of it in terms of the stories being told as Ben and McClellan and the build-up and the press conference to that fight, right, John?
He was Gerald McClellan, by common consent of what we're led to believe, was not a very nice human being. You know, he was into dog fighting. He knocked all his opponents out. He was giving a fairly blood-curdling account of what he was intending to do to Nigel Benn. And it was that was in the days, of course, when it was all newspapers. That was the big thing then. So it was getting massive headlines in the press. And there was a lot of animosity whipped up, I think, by the media as much as anything. I mean, Benn obviously didn't like it, but it was the media's coverage of it which brought the huge public dislike of Gerald McClellan. And you know, we've talked in previous Ringside Rewinds about atmospheres, and I think the atmosphere at the old London Arena for that fight was one of the most hostile I've ever come across anywhere, and that was a result of all the pre-fight publicity which was going in all the papers.
And sometimes you get these very stark contrasts of characters. And Ian, have you ever seen two more different characters than either Eubank and Steve Collins, or Eubank and Nigel Benn?
Well, I remember Eubank. It was great fun at press conferences. There were a few Eubank press conferences you had a bit of a laugh at them because there were kind of funny things that happened. Nobody needed to be having a fight. But I remember Collins walking into the press conference and going right up face to face with Eubank and sort of mouthing about what was going to happen in the fight. And I remember Eubank stepping back and turning to the press and going, "His breath stinks." And then there was another Eubank one. I think it might have been against Maurizio Amaral, you know, one of the lesser opponents. And the guy read out this kind of pathetic poem, which was sort of, you know, childlike, and like sort of, "You might fall like a tree in round three, or I could see you hitting the floor in round four." And this, it went on in this vein. And at the end of it, one of the journalists says to Eubank, he goes, what do you say to all that, Chris? He goes, "Not exactly Shakespeare, was it?" talking about laughs at press conferences, you know, I mean, John and I were involved in the one with the Nassim Hamid fight. I think it was in Detroit, wasn't it, John? We call it the Monster Mash press conference. So, I mean, younger listeners to this might not remember the hit record involved called the Monster Mash. I was sitting in my bedroom late one night when I decided. Well, how did it go, John?
Bobby Puckett and the Crypt Kicker Five.
Right.
I was sitting in my office late one night when I came up with the thought of a Hamid fight.
But we did that. To tell the story properly, Cedric Kushner had been brought in because there'd been some problem with the promotion to kind of front it all up and be the project. And he goes, "Well, thank you, everybody, and welcome to Detroit, where we're going to be seeing Prince Nazim Hamid defending his featherweight championship at the weekend." So John and I are sitting in the back. John turns to me and goes, because his voice sounded like the lead singer in this band, and goes, "I was sitting in my office late one night when I decided to promote a Hammett fight." So I burst out laughing. John's laughing, and Barry Hearn was up there as well, and stops the press conference and says, "Do you want to share the joke, Darky? John, want to share the joke?" "No, you're all right, carry on." I mean, we just, and then you came out that line about Morales and his son.
we got one of the journalists, I think it was the guy who worked for the Sunday Mirror at the time, we got him to actually believe that in a previous life the much traveled Cedric Kushner had actually worked as a session musician and had fronted the match and the lyrics on it, and he bloody wrote it. He put it in the paper.
Do you remember when that guy Prince Charles Williams, you know, that fighter called Prince Charles Williams, he came to London to fight, and Mike Marley was at the press conference. He'd come over. So, yeah, Mike Marley, New York writer, he was quite a funny guy. And after he'd finished talking, Marley puts up his hand and goes, "Hey, you're in London. Any plans to go and see the real Prince Charles while you're here?" There was another one with Michael Moore, who was a strange individual. And he walked in and just sat there, and nobody said anything. Nobody introduced the press conference. He just sat down and nothing happened. Like, it was a silence for about a minute. And eventually he pulled a sort of packet out of his pocket of sweets, of mints, and he goes, "Anybody want a mint?" And that's how the press conference started.
Oh, geez. I guess it was an icebreaker. So how about... Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you guys got that. Any unusual venues for press conferences? Because I suppose over the years, we've done stadiums, we've done castles, we've done different countries. There's been all sorts of places. Is there anywhere that stands out, or is it a stadium's about as good as it got? Or I'm just trying to think. There's been some improvised ones. Obviously, we had, obviously all through COVID, it was BT Studios for you, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, we had a lot of those, and that was a very weird atmosphere. And doing fights as well in BT Studios, and you know, no crowd, no. It makes you realise when you've got a press conference with nobody there, you know, media sort of, I don't know, 5 yards apart and way, way back. It makes you realise how much fighters do thrive off human contact, if you like, human human interaction. When you take the crowds away from it, and including press conferences, it's a very difficult artificial environment. And boxing did well to keep going through that time, really, but I tell you, it wasn't easy.
I remember going back to the first fight I covered with Muhammad Ali and Larry Holmes. I don't think they had like a set piece press conference for it. We all got invited up. We got invited to do some stuff with Ali, but everybody around. And then we all went up to Larry Holmes' suite, and we all had to kind of gather around. I'm trying to get a radio interview, a one-on-one, but there's other people joining in. It was one of those. And I remember Holmes, and I sort of got a question in about sort of, you know, how heavy a puncher he was or something like that. It was a pretty awful question. And Holmes turned round to me, catching my British accent, and he went, "You put that microphone any closer, I'm going to show you."
Wow, what a line.
Oh my God, really?
it was more weigh-ins in those days, wasn't it, than some set-piece press conferences. You know, you got dribs and drabs coming out. I mean, if you remember right back to the Sonny Liston fight back in 1964, you know, Ali in the run-up to it had goaded Liston and said, you know, things like the man can't talk, the man can't fight, the man needs talking lessons, etc., etc. But it was at the weigh-in where it really kicked off, when Ali sort of seemingly feigned completely going bonkers at the weigh-in, and people thought, this guy's terrified, and his blood pressure was up, his pulse rate was racing, and yet a short time afterwards, he was cool, calm and collected. He'd played mind games there with Liston, making him think that he was going in the ring against a crazy man. And maybe, you know, with the benefits of hindsight, looking at the fight, maybe it worked.
And Ian, for, at risk of repetition from a previous episode, when you were out in Tokyo covering Tyson Buster Douglas, what was the pre-fight press conference like out there? And post-fight, was that just the one where Don King was trying to get everyone to believe it was a long count? So pre-fight first and then post-fight.
I don't remember there being much pre-fight at all. It was all extremely low-key. I mean, I think as I've explained before, it was just regarded as a formality. You know, very little media interest considering it was a world heavyweight title defense by Mike Tyson, but that's where we'd kind of got to. There it was in Tokyo. A lot of the American guys hadn't gone. You know, there were only three people from Britain, me, Colin Hart, and a guy from the Mirror. Might have been John Dillon or somebody like that. I can't remember from the time. But so almost nothing. But yeah, it all kicked off afterwards, you know, when Don King tried to have the result made void because he claimed that the count had been too slow in the eighth round and that Douglas had really been knocked out then. And so Tyson was the real winner. But don't worry, he said. Don't worry, everybody. We're going to make sure that Buster Douglas gets a rematch. To which, to their great credit, the American press guys took great exception. And Eddie Schuyler was a very funny guy, worked for AP, stood up and said, "A rematch?" He goes, "What's on the undercard, Tony Dempsey?"
Oh, I do like that. So, John, would you go so far as to say that you've seen a fight won or lost in a press conference, or you know, maybe the odds shift a little bit? Has anyone been able to get an upper hand over an opponent? Because obviously, it's getting to last knockings of those last opportunities to play the mind games. Remember George Groves and the Rubik's Cube and Carl Froch and different things. And I suppose when you think about mind games, I know it wasn't the press conference, but that pull and push thing for me, that really put Carl Froch back in the fight, didn't it? I think he really rattled Groves with that, the head-to-head piece on Sky. Is there anything where you felt a bit of a momentum change after a press conference?
Well, I go back to the one I mentioned at the beginning. I think Fury Wilder, I think Tyson really did get into Deontay's head. Particularly after the second fight in the run-up to the third, because there are all sorts of excuses made by Wilder. And when it came to the fight itself, Wilder had pretty much decided not to speak to him. And if you remember, Tyson grabbed the microphone. He was wearing one of these outrageous suits, and he strutted to the centre of the stage, and he started going on about, tell me why he's changed his team. Tell me why he's got a new trainer. And it got more and more hostile. He said, "Can anybody tell me? Because he can't. He's not got a brain." And then, you know, he started. You could see Wilder starting to smolder, and he called Tyson a bitch. And then Tyson went back at him. You know, you're in denial. You're getting knocked out. Do you know they're laughing at you? You're a dosser. Your legs have gone. The little pussy can't handle the fact that he got his ass handed to him. And then, you know, it carried on and on from there. And eventually Wilder bites, and they're sort of basically shouting at each other across the stage. And if there was ever going to be a face-off, there wasn't one after that. Bob Arum rightly said, that's not going to happen. Because, I mean, they were so, so on edge, the two of them. I think if they'd gone nose-to-nose then, punches unquestionably would have been thrown and the fight could have been pulled.
Yeah, and I suppose that's one of the risks, isn't it? When we do these head-to-head stare-downs at the end of a press conference, that something stupid happens and one of these guys gets cut. I mean, heaven forbid, hey, Ian, the fight gets pulled at the last minute.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm of the view, really, I don't think you can win the fight at the press conference. Not really. I mean, although it's now, there's almost like a tendency for the media to try to declare a winner of the pre-fight stare down and what happened at the press conference. And, you know, we love to talk a bit, not only in boxing, about how, you know, mind games and between football managers as well. But I really do think it boils down to, you know, you might not be a very good, you know, in front of a microphone or a camera, or even that great in talking at a press conference that eloquently. But if you can fight and you tick all the boxes about what you do when you get, you know, between those ropes, that's really what's going to decide it when push comes to shove. So I think a lot of the best performances at press conferences, certainly the ones that have impressed me, is when the guy just looks in the zone. You just get the feeling that he's not to be perturbed, and he's just going through his job here, doing the press conference ahead of time, or almost self-contained, like Tyson used to be really most of the time, you know, in his peak years in the late 1980s. There was a feeling that he knew kind of what was going to happen in the fight, and the rest of it was so much paraphernalia. So I tend to that view, although Jim Watt used to say to me, and you always listen to Jim, and he'd say, did you notice something there amid all that talk? He goes, he never said he was going to win. Never said he was going to win. He said, can you believe that? And I said, oh, yeah. No, he didn't, did he? So sometimes, Tris, sorry to interrupt. You know, when fighters are talking too much and trying to do too much at the press conference, you think, is that all really nervous energy? Is it all a load of bluster?
Ian, I really like that assessment, not just because of the mention of Jim, but it reminded me of something Mick Hennessy said to me once, and it was before Junior Witter fought Timothy Bradley. Bradley had come over from Palm Springs and was not hugely known at the time. He'd had a couple of good wins coming into that fight. And I remember Mick coming up to me quite nervous on the day of the fight, and he said, there's something about this guy that really means business. And it probably is the same box ticked that you're referring to here, whereas Bradley was never a big mouth. He never threw his weight around, or, you know, was ripping his shirt off, or, you know, throwing tables or anything else. But Mick knew that they had their hands full and this was a real pro. And I think that confidence, that self-assuredness, there's you know, it takes a lot of beating, doesn't it? It takes a lot of beating if you've got that self confidence. Yep. Because ultimately, you know, this is what Jose Torres would talk about in terms of boxing being a lie. Who's bluffing? Who can hold their cards closest to their chest? And I suppose this is what we're talking about, right? Who's not giving anything away? Who's got the best poker face?
Yeah, that's right. I think silence can be frightening. Silence can maybe plant a few fears that you're just above all of this, and you're kind of right on top of the job.
Yeah, I get that. And also, you know, you'll know from school days and that, you know, the biggest bullies, empty vessels make the most noise and all the rest of it, right? And I think sometimes there's plenty that can be said for that in boxing. John, if someone had to say you had to go to cover a press conference in this day and age, is that something that you sort of roll your eyes at and think, here we go again?
Well, you roll your eyes at a lot of things, don't you?
I suppose that's boxing cynicism for you.
Yeah. And the more you cover, the more cynical you become. you do like it when it's done in good humour. You know, in the run up to the Hatton Mayweather fight, I don't think there's too much doubt that Ricky Hatton kind of won those advanced press conferences and media appearances, because he was, you know, sort of the Bernard Manning humour on the stage went down brilliantly, didn't it? And I always remember that time when he came over, and it was a press conference prior to that fight in Manchester. Ian might remember it. And Ricky gets up and he starts entertaining the crowd, or giving "There's only one Ricky Hatton," and Mayweather singing along with them. And he said to him, first of all, you know, because Mayweather had been dancing around, he said, "I hope you can fucking dance a bit better than that. We're dancing with stars." He's got no fucking chance. And he also turned to the crowd, and Ricky had been going on about this and that and the fight coming up, and he turns to Mayweather and said, "Floyd, can you stop touching my cock?" He said, "You've been talking all week about my arse. You're going to kick it, you're going to smack it, you're going to whip it." He said, "I'm starting to worry about you." But he also, I mean, Ricky also said he can. He says he's not going to run, and he said, "Well, that's rubbish. We all know he will run." And he said, "I know that because of the guys he's got in as sparring partners. He's hired Forrest Gump and Carl Lewis."
Great. One of the best wits at press conferences was Randall Tex Cobb, wasn't he? The old heavyweight back in the 1980s. I mean, somebody said to him, how much would you want to go and fight Larry Holmes again? He said, 10 cents and a loose woman would do it.
Randall Cobb, as you'd know, Ian, you know, the story was, maybe apocryphal, but knowing some of the stories like that, it makes you think it's probably true, that between rounds, you know, the ring card girl's going round, and instead of listening to his trainer, he's trying to pull the ring card girl.
That's true. I remember somebody asked Larry Holmes, and I can't remember who he was fighting. He said, do you think he might hit harder than Ernie Shavers? And Holmes goes, anybody hits harder than Ernie Shavers, I'm going to shoot him.
Some great stuff. Yeah, really nice stuff there, guys. So I think obviously it's ironic really that we've been talking about press conferences when on the week where we've lost a friend of ours who has been a mainstay with us, press conferences over the years. Very sad news that the wonderful Ron Lewis from the Times and Boxing Scene passed away last week, when ironically enough on the Thursday I was at the Joshua Franklin press conference with him. And Ron passed away the following morning. Really sad news. I suppose, John, it must have shaken you to your core, as it has with me.
It did. I mean, he was a big, gentle soul, was Ron. Didn't like to be particularly at the front of anything, you know, but he was a great listener, and he had a great knowledge. If you spoke to Ron about boxing, you realised how much he knew, and he had a love of other sports as well. I remember bumping Ian and I used to go down to Cheltenham on more than one occasion, and I remember bumping into Ron there, and he was so full of it. He loved his horses, and he wanted to tell me about what was going to win this race and what was going to win that race. And he was a lousy tipster, shocker, but a lovely, lovely, lovely man. And he's going to be very, very badly missed. It was an absolute shock to all of us. And it just goes to show and underlines the fact that we all live by a slender thread, don't we? We never know really when our time is up, and you shouldn't waste time being miserable, worrying about what people think about you. It's a great tribute to Ron. I'll just tell this while I'm thinking about it. When he got dumped on by the Times, which they did, you know, they dropped him after 20 years, and for no real reason, he was left out of work. And he could have taken recourse to going on social media, sounding off on various platforms about what had happened to him, and he never did. He showed great dignity, and that was Ron Lewis.
Yeah, I mean, that I couldn't believe it when I heard the news. He was only 54. He's gone way too soon. I mean, John's paid a handsome tribute, and I'd agree with every word of that. I always found him genuine and genial and amiable. You could always have a laugh with him. He had a ready smile. He knew the business back to front. He was a big QPR fan, wasn't he, as well? He was always talking to me about Queen's Park Rangers and what they might be able to do and recover that season, whatever was going on down there. So very, very sad indeed. That it really is. He really was one of the nicest guys in the media to work with, and you know, rest in peace, Ron.
QPR put a lovely message up at the next home game after he died, just saying, you know, that Ron Lewis, QPR supporter, had died, etc. And I know that it meant on the big electronic scoreboard, that is, and I know that meant so much to his friends and family, and you know, QPR take a lot of credit for that.
Yeah,
I mean, such a softly spoken man has left such a huge impact and a huge space in the press pack, where, you know, it's been nice to have seen him consistently over the last two decades. And I suppose, you know, my last proper, I was very fortunate. The last couple of weeks, I've had three nice interactions with Ron, and we left the Yard-Beterbiev fight at the same time with Chris McKenna the other day, and Ron sort of looked at me when we were out on the streets of Wembley at an ungodly hour and said, you know, you've really got to make the most to see these guys, of seeing these guys when they come over and fight over here. And he said, it was like seeing your Haglers, your Tapias, your Kostya Zoos when they come over. If they're fighting here and you're lucky enough to go and see them, like, make sure that you go and see them. It was almost like it was warning me about things to come, like saying, you know, you make sure that you keep going and seeing them for us. But I won't forget that, because, you know, we talked a bit earlier about cynicism for the business, and I've definitely got that, obviously, having written Damage and everything else. But Ron didn't have, he wasn't a full cynicist. He was a guy who still had that childlike passion for the sport, you know, whether it was amateurs, pros, any level. I've read Matt Christie's great piece about him in Boxing News this week, which is worth the price of the magazine itself, talking about how Ron went out of his way, and you guys will know this, to cover a fight. He would go and be sat there through the undercard as well, because he was interested and he wanted to see the whole lot. Unlike plenty in the press pack, where they arrived during the co-feature, if not just before the main event, he was a man who loved the sport, and it's been very heartwarming to see that the sport loved him in return as well.
He was a fan, wasn't he, as well as a writer. He was always in admiration of those who had the guts to step through the ropes and risk their health effectively for our entertainment. And I hope so much, Triz and Ian, I hope so much that his family have been able to take immense comfort out of the depth of feeling that the boxing world, fans, fighters, promoters, and his peers, journalists, broadcasters, I hope that those close to him, his friends and family, can take great solace out of the really, really genuine outpouring of emotion and respect that's come in the days that followed what was an awful untimely death.
Yeah, I mean, boxing needs all the friends it can get, and I think it's lost a really good friend, isn't it, in Ron?
Yeah, I can't add to that, gents. What an emotional finale to a tale of strange press conferences, weird goings on, good and bad, and the ugly from press conferences as well, to talking about a fine man like Ron Lewis. Gents, it's been a privilege to talk about the late Ron Lewis, and it's been a lot of fun, as always, to talk about the haphazard nature of people's last-ditch sales attempts to get their fight front and centre, whether it's on TV, in print journalism, or on the radio. Guys, if you have enjoyed this podcast, please go and leave us a review and rate us on iTunes or where you choose to listen to us. And we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Triz Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.